The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Washington Post and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These were selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Well, drones have become a frequent topic of news stories, and that's going to be kind of the lead topic for us this morning as we enjoy, or I should say today. I record this in the morning, but obviously it airs on Sunday and Monday. The recent sightings that occurred in New Jersey are just one of several examples of drones that have created headlines in just the past few months. Now, I want to share some headlines from the website ODDE, that's ODDEE, and here are five interesting headlines. Drone carrying Albanian flag causes a riot at soccer match. Hawk versus drone. Drones used to drop drugs in prison yards. Meth drone crashes on U.S.-Mexico border. And dad builds drone to follow son to bus stop. How about that? Well, I think you get the picture, right? So our first story on today's Armchair Travel is going to take us to the Windy City of Chicago. And writer Adriana Perez's article, Drone Chase Highlights Dangers to Owls. Now, this is written for the Chicago Tribune and Tribune News Service, and it also appeared in the January 21st, 2024 online issue of the News and Observer. So let's see what we can learn. On her way home from work on a recent wintry night, Kathy Keene ran into a group of people quietly watching a pair of great horned owls perched on a tree in Lincoln Park. I started hearing the hoo-hoo, and then the other would call back, hoo-hoo, she told the Tribune, and it was just so beautiful. Well, excited about the sighting, she made sure to walk by the same spot the next day with her husband, Patrick Keene. The bird was still on the tree, but then a drone flew toward the owl and scared it away. The Keens decided to approach the two people piloting the aircraft. I'm like, do you realize you scared the owl of that thing, Patrick Keene recalled, and he got, well, I'm not exaggerating here, he got a big smile on his face and said, yeah, we did. And he's like, we scared the other one earlier in the evening. As native great horned owls court and nest in Chicago and expectations ramp up for rare winter sightings of snowy owls from the Arctic, encounters like this underscore the importance of viewing and photographing these birds safely, experts say. The problems of harassing wildlife, and specifically owls, is not a new one, said Edward Warden, president of the Chicago Ornithological Society. There's something incredibly compelling about them as birds. People get excited to see them, and when they're in our midst, whether you call yourself a birder or not, it's kind of a very universal thing, he said. Well, generally, curious humans disturb owls, disturbing owls, is unintentional, but interactions are more likely to occur in the winter when trees have no leaves and the birds are easier to spot, and as breeding season begins. The Chicago Bird Alliance says humans can stress out owls by interfering with their hunting, causing fatigue, and making them more vulnerable to traffic and predators like peregrine falcons or red-tailed hawks. Now, as we continue this, over 4 million great horned owls can be found in a wide variety of habitats across North America. That includes Illinois. The species, often depicted as a wise figure in popular culture and storybooks, the second heaviest owl species in America after snowy owls, great horned owls are known for their hunting skills, big yellow eyes, deep hoots, and their feather tufts on their heads. They nest as early as January, since their owlets need more time than other young birds to learn to hunt on their own ahead of the next winter, according to the Chicago Bird Alliance. They can handle a lot, and the fact that they are even making their trip into a city, which is inherently a harsher environment than a nice, cozy forest preserve, Warden said. These are already hard-working animals. They're doing their best to scrape out a living in what can really be a challenging space and environment. Mac Aglesky, executive director of the Chicago Bird Alliance, said that waking up nocturnal animals like great horned owls in the middle of the day is like waking up a person in the middle of the night, forcing them to run around and expecting them to perform well the next morning. Especially during the winter, owls are running on a very tight energy budget, Warden said, and they need to make every calorie count to keep warm and survive. If they spend their time avoiding humans and fleeing drones, they're burning precious energy. And it's not hyperbole at all to say that if these birds are harassed enough, they can die from it, he said. We've seen it happen many times before. Every winter, Chicagoans cross their fingers in hopes of spotting snowy owls in and around the city. Iglesias said he has experienced plenty of impromptu sightings along the wet lakefront. When you do find one, all of a sudden it turns and it has eyes and you're like, oh, he said, it's just a big chunky owl and it's almost all white. And in the wintertime, it's just a scene that sort feels very winter, you know. It's hard to describe it, but it just puts you in the moment of, this is so cool that we're sharing this cold day together. Their visits are rare, which only heightens excitement around sightings and leads to more encounters with humans. The sporadic presence of these owls in northern U.S. states is hard to predict. Their loosely cyclic migration to the south, referred to as eruption, is decided by several factors, including climate and inclement weather, food availability, and population numbers. For instance, when Arctic lemming population, the predator's main food source, is abundant and allows many young snowy owls to feed and survive, intense competition for food leads many of them to migrate south to hunt for other prey like voles, mice, and rabbits. Warden said in the past decade, Illinois has seen only two big snowy owl eruptions, one in the winter of 2013-14 and another in the winter of 2017-18. During the latter, well over a dozen snowy owls were regularly seen throughout the Chicago area. At least three were spotted on the museum campus. Because they are often awake during the day and their white plumage makes them highly visible in the city, these northern visitors are easy for humans to find and to disrupt. Snowy owls are also susceptible to stress since they're young, often only 6 or 7 months old, and have less experience and stamina than adults. After traveling thousands of miles, the full-grown birds may be more dehydrated and exhausted than they look. The wintertime presence of snowy owls in Canada and the United States is already limited, but it might become even rarer as climate change affects Arctic food webs and wintering snowy owls remain closer to home. All these things kind of throw the traditional pattern into a less predictable pattern, and it all ties together to basically create less predictability and more chaos, Warden said. Snowy owl population sharply declined by 64% between 1970 and 2014, and the International Union for Conservation of Nature classified them as vulnerable, a vulnerable species, I should add, in 2021. Now, can we point to climate change as the primary culprit? Probably not, Warden added, but can we point to it as a culprit? Most certainly. Climate change is an additional stressor that might make snowy owl eruptions less common. When you look at a snowy owl, Warden said, that one owl is part of a picture. It's part of a population of birds that are working hard to survive and keep their species alive. And we know there's already pressures that are really making it harder for them to do that every year. So, if that means that we should go out of our way to make sure that the one thing we're seeing today can rest a little easier, why wouldn't we want to do that? This bird's signature silent, wide-eyed stare can actually be a clear indicator of stress. If an owl looks at a person frequently, it probably means that person is too close. They're actually incredibly expressive, and if you know how to read the signs, they tell you what they're thinking. They tell you how they feel about your presence, Warden said. A great horned owl is king in the food chains, but it's still going to be frightened of you. We are still the big boys on the block here. If an owl's eyes are closed, half-closed, or focused elsewhere, that's a good sign. While the bird might be aware of a human's presence, it's not concerned about it. When people spot an owl in the wild, they should be as quiet as possible and maintain their distance using binoculars for viewing. Flash photography should always be avoided, especially after dark. Experts also suggest not sharing exact sighting locations to ensure the bird's safety. You don't want to be unnecessarily policing people for their interactions with wildlife, Warden said. I find that a lot of time there is a disconnect in recognition. It's usually not somebody trying to be actively mean or hurtful when you find examples of harassment. So oftentimes these kinds of things just involve somebody speaking up. A lot of people are already kind of inherently prepared to have that degree of emotional connection and sympathy with the wildlife around them. Sometimes it takes a little hand-holding. But then there are more extreme cases like the Keene's interaction. I was so upset, and I kind of wish we had said more, maybe been more confrontational, Kathy Keene said. I was so surprised that the man's response was literally excitement that he had scared and chased the owls away, that I think I didn't really know how to respond in the moment. But by the time I got home, I thought, this is so wrong. Something has to be done. According to Illinois law, it is illegal to take, pursue, or intentionally harass or disturb in any manner any wild birds or mammals by use of or aid of any vehicle, conveyance, or unmanned aircraft. Violating this law is a Class A misdemeanor and punishable by a fine of at least $500 and up to $5,000. Concerns about drones disturbing wildlife in city parks should be directed to the Chicago Park District. Now, per the Chicago Park District's code, the use of apparatus for aviation, including drones, is prohibited on park property without a permit, said a district spokesperson in an emailed statement to the Tribune. The code also provides that no person shall harass or harm in any manner any animal or bird on park property. Violators are subject to removal from the park. Chicago Park District Security works closely with the Chicago Police Department to enforce Park District code. Iglesky suggested that those interested in viewing owls find trips and walks organized by local birding organizations, which can provide a space to learn about and observe them respectfully. Recognize that you both need that space, Iglesky said. We're not the only creatures that exist here, and we really do need to be more aware of the entirety of who is using these areas. It's not just for us, it is for the animals, and a lot of these populations have been either living here or migrating through here for thousands and thousands of years. Owls and other animals like foxes and coyotes can be beneficial for city problems such as rodent infestation, which has earned Chicago the title of rattiest city in America for 9 straight years. Warden said people need to remember animals lived in the area long before Chicago came along. So you slap a major city in here, you're going to see some wildlife try to come back in, he said. There's well over 300 species of birds that are found in Chicagoland annually at some point in the year, and that's truly a remarkable number and a remarkable testament to the fact that there is room for everybody, so to speak. Kathy Keene said human boundaries are inevitably and increasingly going to bump into wildlife. She adds, as our urban areas expand, animals still have to have a place to live. We need to find a way to coexist respectfully. Well, next, we have writer Ann Rodriguez-Jones. Tell us about the next phase of the true crime boom. It's called Themed Tours, yeah? Her article appeared in the January 16, 2025 issue of the Washington Post, and her research found that true crime tourists are willing to shell out to see the sites of mob hits, serial killer traits, and missing persons cases. Now more. The Mafia Walking Tour starts at St. John's of 12th Street, one of Manhattan's oldest red sauce joints. Just outside, our guide informs us, is where the Lucky Luciano shot Umberto Valenti. Now, Dennis O'Leary begins the tour by showing us his official NYPD badge. The retired detective, 62, has seen his share of murders, but he conducts the tour with a light and friendly tone. Just about everyone in Little Italy seems to know him. He will happily give guests his cell phone number if they need help securing a reservation at John's. As we meander down the streets of the East Village into a Little Italy and then to Chinatown, he gives us the scoop on New York City's underbelly of organized crime. There is a stop at the Ravenite Social Club, which acted as the headquarters of the Gambino crime family. We gather near the old Milo printing, where O'Leary says fake stocks and bonds were printed for the Mafia. Remember Goodfellas? Well, the two characters who killed Joe Pesci in the movie had a favorite haunt, and we visit that too. A 2024 poll from YouGov showed us that 57% of U.S. adults consume true crime content, and that 5% do so every day. Podcasts, documentaries, and streaming series are wildly popular. The travel industry is responding with an influx of macabre tours, true crime tourism, if you will. O'Leary's Mafia Tour began in 2017 as a way to bring people to his beloved neighborhood. He touts himself as someone who will cut the BS and give you an insider's perspective, unquote. The bulk of people are interested in true crime, he says, adding that any new media like a documentary or podcast, and especially the Academy Award-nominated movie The Irishman, can give this business a boost. Following killers and victims. In Milwaukee, a walking tour for the Cream City Cannibal follows serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer's footsteps. A Chicago crime tour takes place in an air-conditioned bus. French Quarter Phantoms tells the story of colorful characters such as the never-apprehended Axeman of New Orleans, an unidentified serial killer who went on a rampage in the early 20th century and who, like Jack the Ripper, had a penchant for mocking the media. Art Markman, a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, says that humans have an inherent interest in true crime because stories like these enable us to be transported into situations that we shouldn't find ourselves in normally, and that we can experience extreme emotions that go beyond our daily lives. We love reading crime stories, whodunits, police procedurals, and other genres that for that reason, he says, and true crime adds the additional component that the story itself is true, which can heighten the creepiness, fear, or sense of injustice, depending on the nature of the story, he added. Kim Cooper, 57, co-owner of Esoteric Tours and the Secret Heart of Los Angeles, says their business, established in 2007, stemmed from their true crime blog. Now their tours blend historic crime stories with a mix of culture, history, and architecture. They offer two purely true crime tours in downtown Los Angeles, The Real Black Dahlia and Human Sacrifice. Cooper notes that a lot of new visitors have come to Los Angeles to learn about the infamous Cecil Hotel after the death of Elisa Lam, the 21-year-old Canadian student who was visiting the city and whose body was found in a water tank on the roof of the hotel 19 days after she was first reported missing. True crime is pretty consistently a draw for our guests, Cooper says, and even if they're not familiar with the lesser-known cases we cover, they are interested in the topic. The popularity of podcasting. True crime podcasts and dramas have exploded in popularity, satisfying consumers' hunger for in-depth storytelling on a platform that is easily binge-worthy. Serial got people talking about the genre, and it seemed to explode from there with such entries as Dr. Death and Crime Junkie. The Hulu series Only Murders in the Building is built around a fictional true crime podcast produced by the main characters, with an arc built around a podcast host played by Tina Fey. Markman says that true crime requires resources to investigate, and that an investigation may not pay off depending on what the investigator finds. He believes that podcasting changed this. Podcasting in particular lowered the overhead necessary to distribute content, which made it easier for people to engage in an investigation in the hope that it would lead somewhere interesting enough to hold an audience. According to a 2024 poll from YouGov, 61% of women said they consume true crime content compared with 52% of men, and more than 60% of adults between 30 and 64 said they tune in. Americans are split as to whether the genre is acceptable from a moral perspective. More people say it is ethical, 50%, to consume true crime content than say it is unethical, 16%. And 38% say it is ethical to make true crime content. Well, Ryan Murphy's hit Netflix show, Dahmer, Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story, received significant backlash from families of Dahmer's victims who called the show such things as greedy and re-traumatizing. I'm the writer and host of a popular true crime podcast about my hometown in the Ozarks, and I have spent the past three seasons working to navigate the growing appetite for true crime while ensuring the story is told accurately and respectfully toward the victims and their families. And again, we're talking about Ann Rodriguez-Jones when she refers to I here. However, as she writes, that doesn't mean the podcast is void of well voyeurs. Beyond tours, armchair detectives are choosing authorizing travel based on specific cases. Hello, Armchair Detectives. Kevin Allen, 54, a software executive from Raleigh, North Carolina, said he travels specifically for true crime. Allen became interested in several cases, including the Springfield 3, and thinks of them as a puzzle waiting to be solved. I found Allen in a private Facebook group that is devoted to the case, which involves three women from the Ozarks who went missing in 1992 and have yet to be found. The group has more than 3,000 members, with people constantly sharing information, theories, and tips about the case. This isn't in any way meant to minimize the real violence and impact on the victims and their families, many of whom I have spoken with and gotten to know, he said, and if I can be any part of that effort, I want to do so. Allen drove to Springfield, Missouri, to visit the sites connected with the Springfield 3 case, and he went directly to the possible scene of the crime, a residential home where the three women were probably taken from. He walked around the entire block of the house, and he even met up with a local armchair detective, whom he met via Facebook. These cases take on a whole new meaning when you put yourself at the scene of the crime. You get a feel for the setting, the dimensions, and feel of the area, Allen said. It really makes a difference in the way you look about you think about these cases, and I find it very helpful as you try to get into the head of the perpetrator, he added. Armchair detectives such as Allen might add a new layer to the onion in hopes to peel back parts of the case, but what happens when Internet sleuths descend upon a location in hopes to solve a mystery? O'Leary, who previously worked in law enforcement, said armchair detectives can actually find new information and be a new set of eyes. As long as they don't interfere with the investigation, which would be illegal, he said, they can be an asset in fact-finding. It's then up to the police to see whether there's credence to any findings. Now, media attention and ethical concerns is the final part of the story. It says media coverage or even tourism can help to bring attention to a case. Podcasts such as Up and Vanished and Your Own Backyard have helped to uncover crucial evidence that aided in cracking real crimes. I've realized I enjoy unsolved cases more. With unsolved case, a podcast can at least bring more attention to it and potentially help generate tips, Allen says. But are true crime tours and travel sensationalizing the crimes? Well, as in, can you be sensitive to victims while charging money for a tour? Markman points out that if you are a public figure, you can reasonably expect a certain amount of scrutiny of your life and habits. A celebrity having a meal may get asked for a picture or autograph, and reporters may pry into the details of a famous person's life, but the victim and family of a victim of crime did not sign on for notoriety, he says. Markman suggests that tour operators should tread lightly when it comes to engagement with the family of a victim. After all, they may be still grieving. When I posed this question to Cooper, she says there is always a danger of sensationalism, and it comes down to who is giving these tours, their motivation, and their knowledge of the material. When guides are hired to work from a script, if that script is exploitative, the tour will be too. Her visits outside the Cecil Hotel, which now serves as supported housing, rather than going in because that's people's home. Cooper is not only a horror story aficionado, but also a champion for Los Angeles storytelling. She says that true crime is a special niche and that the crossover between it and L.A. is special. People are interested in this, but when it happens in your own hometown, there are places that hold these echoes, she says. Well, to conclude our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let's offer a guide to Hercule Dirkling. Now, Scotland's proud tradition of lazing in bed is what it means. Travel writer Andrea Sachs' article appeared in the January 22, 2025 issue of the Washington Post. Ms. Sachs' subhead reads, "Do you struggle to get out of bed in the morning? Boy, have we got the travel trend for you. On vacation, you might suppress the urge to seize the day. Instead, you sink deeper into the sheets, disappearing under the duvet like the moon behind a cloud. By all appearances, you're doing nothing but quite the opposite. You're Hercule Dirkling." Now, Hercule Dirkling is not a cutesy term generated by artificial intelligence or the travel PR machine. It's a 19th-century Scottish word that the dictionaries of the Scots language defines as to lie in bed or lounge about when one should be up. The practice is experience and resurgence, a calming antidote to the frenzy of travel, a finger to the lips, to the clamor outside your hotel door. Now, some people think we need to fill every hour with activities, said Caroline McChriston, a photographer and lifestyle expert based in Scotland. But sometimes it's nice to lean into a rest when you're far away from home. In September 2023, Susie Dent, a celebrity lexicographer from England, chose herkoderkling as her word of the day, admitting on TikTok that she's a herkoderkler. Now, the following January, McKiston demonstrated the concept in an Instagram post that garnered more than 145,000 likes. In the clip, she burrows under the covers, reads a book, sips a hot beverage, knits, and gazes out the window at a frosted Isle of Skye landscape, ideal herkoderkling conditions. I do be herkling and I do be dirkling, the video says, and once I've herkled my last dirkle in a given morning, I will get up. The custom even appears in Hilton's 2025 Trends report, where the hospitality company noted a growing interest in herkoderkling, a more alert version of the sleepcation among hotel guests. Both trends fall under the booming category of wellness tourism, a sector the Global Wellness Institute projects will exceed $1 trillion this year. Whoever thought there'd be money in sleeping? Anyway, unlike other wellness experiences such as silvotherapy, you need to hike to the forest to bathe in it, or snoga, yoga in snow, herkoderkling takes no effort whatsoever. The concept is that you're staying in bed a little longer than you should have and not feeling any pressure to go anywhere or do anything, said Michael McKish, the Scottish vice president of Away from the Ordinary and a travel agency that specializes in Scotland. You're just enjoying, he said, the luxuriousness of going nowhere and staying comfy and cozy under the covers. How to herkoderkle? Well, to properly herkoderkle, you need a cozy place to lie, such as a bed, fainting couch, or chaise. It's typically a dry sport, so a soaking tub or steam room does not qualify. Well, the optimal position is flat on your back, curled up like a fiddlehead, or reclining against a heap of pillows. Standing up, with the exception of opening the door for room service, is frowned upon. Whatever you wore to bed, we'll keep on wearing it. McKiston with herkoderkling is personal, shaped by your environment, amenities, and a style of relaxing. Her toolkit features a bed, pajamas, and a cup of coffee. As long as it's doing your body and soul good and not causing harm to anyone by neglecting what you need to do for them, she said, then I'd say you're herkoderkling. McQuish, who considers himself an expert, suggests pairing your herkoderkling with another Scottish pastime, quarry. He describes it as an act of snuggling and finding somewhere warm, such as cozying up by a fire with a good book and a wee dram. Now, to make it a true herkoderkle, replace the couch or overstuffed chair with a bed. Herkoderkling typically occurs in the morning. Depending on your meal schedule, it can overlap with breakfast. Now, for Scotland visitors, McQuish recommends staying at a hotel known for its full Scottish breakfast, such as the Glen Eagles, the Auk Tartar, or the Balmoral in Edinburgh. It's traditional to get a little nip, McQuish says, so whilst you're herkoderkling, you can have a little morning whiskey with your porridge. I don't know. Anyway, my friends, that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey. Hope you've enjoyed your herkoderkle, too. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and we certainly hope you've enjoyed your journey today and that you'll join us again next time. We remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and the Armchair Traveler program is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, any comments or questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.